thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I do.
Here's John Williams.
Even on weekends, which means Monday, I'm just chock full of whatever that is. I'm chock full of. Hi, it's John. We're downtown Chicago.
Lord have mercy.
18 stories above a beautiful city that Condé Nast said was the number one place in the country and the world. Blue skies. It's a beautiful fall day. By the way, when I was just chatting with Steve Bertrand, I made it sound like Applefest in the Lincoln Square neighborhood of Chicago was a bad thing. It was a little crowded, but we were there early enough that it wasn't so bad for us. And the reason we really went, besides the fact that my son and daughter-in-law asked us to come along, was for the apple pie. Producer Elif was like, oh, you've got to try the apple pie. And as you're walking through this thing, there's a guy out there going, the line for the apple pie is over here. He knew that we were going to be in the line for the apple pie. So, like, you know, sheep, we got into the line for the apple pie because that's what you do. And when you get there, they give you a slice of apple pie that is thick with the perfect kind of crust with big apples, just the right mix of butter and cinnamon and sugar, and on top a dollop for which you will pay extra, and you will be thankful that you did, of whipped cream.
So there's no way that guy was waiting in line himself, right? Because he wouldn't want more people in line.
Well, this guy was working for the apple pie line.
Oh, of course.
He was working for the booth. And so we got in line and we got up there. I gave that man $7 and said, thank you very much.
And that's an expensive piece of pie.
It was worth $7.
Oh, man.
You know what I really loved about that pie? Excuse me.
This is apple pie season. I'm an apple pie guy. Apple crisp, apple pie, apple cider, apple brandy, apple, yes, I'm in.
Is that they don't use a lot of sugar in the whipped cream or in the pie itself.
Yeah.
Right?
I hadn't thought about that. It wasn't too sweet.
Right.
It just kind of had the tartness of the apples. There was the right blend of cinnamon.
So that stood out as opposed to sugar.
Yeah, for me. I'll tell you what, it was pretty dang good. Was it Jerry's apple pie, I think they call it? Something like that. And I'm wondering now, can you get that apple pie other places, other wares, or somewhere over there in Lincoln Square? I don't know. But that was a beautiful thing for us. It sort of took the edge off an otherwise disappointing weekend for Bears fans. The Bears headline in the Chicago Tribune today is, not okay in UK. But the Sun-Times is probably better at the headline game than the Tribune. Tribune, great reporting. Sun-Times, great headlines. Sun-Times headline, London fog.
Huh?
Huh? Come on now. Come on now.
That's good. I like that one. That one's a little bit more clever.
Later in the story, they had another, or later in the paper, they had another headline, Royal Blush. So this is one of the best times of year, though, because not only do you have NFL football, you have NHL hockey. Welcome back, Lauren Lapka.
Thank you.
Regular season football, regular season or, you know, playoff season baseball, and regular season, let's see, we have hockey. So we have hockey, we have football, we have baseball, and basketball games are in the exhibition season. You can go watch the Bulls play basketball this week. So you've got all four of the sports going. Still no word on who Madden's replacement is going to be yet, though, right? The story in Condé Nast about Chicago comes at a good time because last week we were all talking about Chicago and, you know, concluding that there's a lot of reasons why people are leaving the city. The Tribune did a story about reasons folks are leaving Illinois as part of their Illinois Exodus series. Thank you very little. And there were a lot of good reasons, like taxes and corrupt politicians and the cost of living and stuff like that. But here's Condé Nast writing, second city, not by our count. Chicago was world-class in so many categories. Magnificent architecture, stunning museums, brilliant chefs, a massive brewing scene. I pointed that out. And so much to do that you'll never see it all. But it's worth a shot. Scratch the surface in the Loop and on the Gold Coast. Those are major hubs for visitors. If you come to Chicago and you go to the Gold Coast, you have missed so much. I wouldn't start there, but enjoy. There's nice restaurants there, which are major hubs for visitors, and then go deeper into the city's 77 neighborhoods. One thing is constant. You'll meet some of the most pleasant people you'll find anywhere, said Condé Nast. They said that they had 600,000 readers around the world vote on the awards this year. Number one, Chicago. Number two, Minneapolis. Condé Nast praised it, according to the Tribune, for having one of the best park systems in the country. I'll second that. A robust culinary scene and that whole Minnesota nice thing, which frankly is way oversold. Number three on the list, New Orleans. Four, Washington. Five, Washington, D.C., of course. Five is San Diego. Six, New York City. Seven, Pittsburgh. Good for you. Number eight, Honolulu. Number nine, San Antonio. Three was Boston, New Orleans, Washington, D.C., San Diego, New York City, Pittsburgh. Honolulu was nine, and San Antonio, Texas, is number 10. So there you go. 600,000 people around the world voted Chicago best big city in the U.S. of A. We'll talk to them a little bit later on. It's kind of funny because one of the things that they said, when you come to Chicago, they have where to stay, what to eat, what to do. Number one on the list of things to do, the Field Museum. Number two, the Museum of Science and Industry. Now, this Museum of Science and Industry story is still interesting to me because, as you recall, last week we talked about it on this show, and we sure got a dose of it on the Mincing Rascals podcast. I don't know if you listen to podcasts. You should listen for the Mincing Rascals. But the gang kicked around the idea that the official name of the Museum of Science and Industry is now the Kenneth C. Griffin Museum of Science and Industry. The billionaire philanthropist donated $125 million to it. Neil Steinberg wrote about this in the Sun-Times today. And what a take. What a take, Neil. Are you serious? Did you just say that about the Museum of Science and Industry? Neil Steinberg, the columnist in the Chicago Sun-Times, wrote about the changing of the name of the Museum of Science and Industry to the Kenneth C. Griffin MSI, and he doesn't have any problem with that. You donate a lot of money to a thing, you can put your name on it, he said. He said, look, it's the Willis Tower. It's Guaranteed Rate Field now. He reminded us of what the name of the Hancock Center is. Steve Bertrand, do you know what the name of the Hancock Center or Hancock Building is? Lapka, do you know what the name of the Hancock Building is now?
It's Hancock?
It's the 960 North Michigan Building or something, or whatever the address is.
Yeah, that's what it's called now.
That's awful.
It's now 875 North Michigan Avenue.
Well, I guess you can't forget the address.
Yeah. Hey, honey, where is 875? Oh, never mind. Never mind.
What's the number to 911?
Exactly. That's what it is. So they got that going for him. So he doesn't have any trouble with you getting to stamp your name on the side of a building if you give $125 million to it.
You're the only one who does.
No, I don't think so.
Really?
I don't know. The text line was pretty even on this. I mean, hey, Steve, listen, two things. One, Griffin, good man, thank you for the donation. No problems with you making a donation. If it were me, and I had a zillion dollars, I think I don't know that I would want my name stamped on the side of the building. But if he wants it, I guess if that propels the mission of the Museum of Science and Industry, then if they're cool with it, I guess it's none of my beeswax.
Yeah, I think Eric Zorn was saying in the Rascals, it's a sort of a legacy thing. I mean, almost every museum, the Art Institute is the only one in town, right, that doesn't have...
Field is named after Marshall Field.
Shed is named after...
John Shed.
There's John C. Shedd.
Adler is named after the Adlers.
Philip Adler or Mortimer Adler, the 20th century philosopher? No, not him.
So they all got their thing. So now the MSI is going to have a name attached to it. But here's what he also said. I thought he was going to join us now. It looks like he's not, but I'll read what he wrote. He said, he says, this is the key point. It isn't as if the MSI, or as he now calls it, the KCG MSI, isn't already compromised, already nestled in the pocket of big money donors. Between nostalgic exhibits touting the faded industrial giants of the past, a coal mine, a sprawling toy train layout, and exhibits that are practically product placements for corporations, the river of donor money has already dug a fairly deep trench and what should have been called the Museum of Industry and Science. Go and visit a real science museum in Toronto and London, and you'll realize that ours is more of a walk-in, point-of-purchase display. Adding Griffin's name is like slapping a fresh layer of rouge on the cheeks of a streetwalker after a long night. neither detracting from nor improving an entity whose allure is debatable. Frankly, Steinberg wrote, I'm surprised anyone would want to associate their name with the place. That's good writing, but that's just too mean. I don't think that's fair. I'm not going there. That's
When's the last
point.
Time you were there?
I'll tell you what. It was about 5 or 6 years ago, and I do think he has a point about it not being as fun or interesting. That I totally was getting what he was saying. Why do you ask, Steve?
Well, because we took the kids a few times, and I mean, I wouldn't be as direct as Neil, but it was just a time kill. It was just something to do with on a rainy afternoon. You know, I don't remember anything being especially compelling about it.
I feel the same way, and I feel like that's always me. Like,
maybe you saw the chicks hatch.
But I need to spend more time thinking about and investing in the things that they're asking me to think about when I go there. You know, maybe it's me. Maybe I'm not curious or smart enough, or I don't know. Maybe I'm just not a museum guy. MSI has never... in the, you know, how many times have I been there in my life? 5, but it's not made me a person who always wants to come back. One last note about Neil Steinberg's piece, then I wanted to mention something else that happened to me over the weekend. At the end of Steinberg's piece in the Sun-Times about the Museum of Science and Industry, and okay, they can have their name, but why would you want to put your name on it? He said, the very place that you're sitting right now, if you're in much of Chicago, was named after somebody. Do you know who that is? Do you know who Cook was? Or is, was.
I know, I think a friend of mine wrote a play about the guy Streeter.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah, Streeter, that's a fascinating fella.
He was a pirate, right?
Who yes. Kind of, who lived on the river, kind of just like on his own.
And just in the swampy area or something?
Yeah,
and,
right, exactly.
So that's how it became Streeterville.
Streeterville. Daniel Pope Cook was an abolitionist, a newspaper publisher, and Illinois' first attorney general. He died in 1827 at the age of 33, and his last name is the one on countless official documents. It doesn't change the fact that he's dead and forgotten, and that's something that, see, so this is just Steinberg's take, Ken Griffin should think about, that you put your name on something doesn't mean people always remember you, even though they might know the name. Fair enough. You want to spend your money that way, you get to. There I was coming out of the Home Depot on Halsted this weekend.
And you know who that's named after.
Halsted? Be the Halsteds, if I'm not mistaken.
I was going to say Home Depot, but...
I walked out of the Home Depot there on Halsted and heading south, bound on a fancy bicycle with fancy bicycle equipment, was a fancy bicyclist. You know where this story is going. In the same lane, heading also south, was a midsize SUV. And I don't know what happened. It got the two of them angry at each other, but one of them did something the other one didn't like. And so the SUV hits the gas, zooms forward about 50 yards, and then locks up his brakes, turning into the curb so that he's now, as the bicycle approaches him, he's sort of pinned the bicycle between him and the curb. Now the bicyclist can't get out of the way. There's the curb there. He's not going to run over that on his fancy bike. And the vehicle is to his left. He's kind of stuck there now. So he stopped, and the door opens up. The car's halfway parked into the southbound lane of traffic on Halsted, and the guy gets out and runs over, screaming words that we don't say on WGN. He goes chest to chest with the bicyclist, who's like, game on, let's go. I'm a bicyclist. And so they are having a top-of-their-lungs discussion about whatever it is that happened 50 yards back. Halsted's kind of a busy place on a Saturday afternoon, and so there's a lot of people just walking around, and what do they all do? Anyone? What does a passerby do when something like this happens?
Either get their phone out or just walk by and not get involved.
Both.
Yep.
A lot of people just whipped out their phones and go, okay, this is cool. The one guy's going to hit the other guy. The other guy's going to hit the other guy. They're going to roll around the street and I'll have video. That's what we do now. So everybody's videoing this. And frankly, the thing ended after about 30 seconds of high-volume nastiness, and then the cyclist thought, I don't want to go to jail or the hospital, so he kind of like moseyed around the guy, and then he continued south on Halsted. And then the driver of the vehicle sort of has a, looks around, realizes there's about 50 people, half of them videotaping him, and he sort of salutes them with his elbow and his fist, and then he walks back to his car. the 50 people or so that were watching kind of had a wah-wah expression on their face because now they've got video they don't really need.
Taking up so much space on the phone.
You could just see them all going, delete, delete, delete. Come on, man. I was that close to going viral.
Just thinking TMZ, man.
I know. This is like 50 bucks if you just punch them once. The moral of the story is, don't be in a hurry and allow people to make mistakes. There are few areas of human interaction we have where we are less tolerant of somebody making an honest mistake. And I know you have your attitude about cyclists. And cyclists, you probably don't like cars. Generally, I think bicyclists are the bad guys in these stories, but that's neither here nor there. The point is, you ought to let the other guy make a mistake. Car, bike, one guy's a jerk, the other guy, whatever. Why is it that when somebody makes a mistake, and this happens car too, right? You run up to them and you're honking and you're giving them the finger out the window. They made a mistake.
This totally happened to me this weekend where...
Let them make a mistake.
I was coming out of the post office and I needed to make a left turn and it was near a stoplight and the car in front of me, or the car on the street by the red light, stopped sort of in front of the driveway for the post office, right?
Yeah.
So I could, first of all, I'm like, what? Oh, come on, why'd you do this? And then I eked over to the left on an angle because I thought I could cut through. And as I cut through, all of a sudden cars were coming on the opposite direction.
Right.
I couldn't get there. So now I was blocking a lane of traffic.
Boy, because I
did something stupid.
Yeah.
And so rather than, you know, take the grief, I just started flipping off everyone else.
You did not.
No.
You did
but,
not.
But, you know, it's just like put my hands in the air. I'm like, I am so sorry. I totally screwed up.
I think that's what it is. You need to own it. If, for instance, you're the car gridlocking an intersection and there's somebody like just sitting there in your window because you're in the middle of traffic and they can't go, I think you owe them a little Now, some of you aren't going to do that because you fully intended to gridlock the thing so that you could eventually get your way through. You are bad and you are evil. But to the innocent gridlockers, just own it. And then to the other people, they made a mistake. You're going to miss a cycle of the light. Let people make mistakes. You may comment if you choose. Speaking of the Bears, after the Chicago Bears' surprising loss to the Oakland Raiders in London yesterday, once again, on this edition of A Chicago Bears Fan's Life, we find three Grabowskis named Obradovich, Hampton, and Kozlowski sitting at a bar in Lockport.
Let's put the cheese on the cracker here.
There's a lot of dark clouds that are coming our way in the near future here.
Oh, I mean, this is... I'm telling you, this one's going to reek. And you got 2 weeks for this to be rubbed in.
And Nagy... You better get your act together. Stop your trick plays.
Nagy was calling plays like Neville Chamberlain in the first half. In the second half, he came out acting more like Thatcher.
His trick plays and his psychological things and all whatever he does. Just get down to some basic coaching.
They all think they're so great. And I'm telling you what, Anthony Miller, you little... You... All I'm telling you is this. This team, I'd like to buy them for what they're worth and sell them for what they think they're worth.
We got totally outcoached and totally outplayed today against a team we should have taken down any day of the week.
You know, I heard Dick is spouting off this week. Oh, yeah, this is one of the greatest defenses ever. Maybe better than... Where's the $141 million Khalil Mack? He's on the sidelines breathing hard. What is it, 50 degrees in London?
What are you thinking on fourth and six? What are you rushing?
Trying like to block the punter.
Nobody else was doing it. I think this guy's an idiot.
The only thing that you had to worry about was protect the fake punt.
Quite frankly, that's embarrassing that you're wearing a pro jersey.
How dare you?
And I got to say it. You know, everybody wants to go, oh, Urlacher, blah, 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 blah. Urlacher should have been a man and thrown Cutler around in the locker room and said, hey, stop all the idiocy, act like a man, be a man, go out there and play the game, and don't act like it's all about you, punk. And if he would have, maybe he would have straightened Cutler out. Nobody else ever did. God, you better believe you, we would have done that. We would have done that.
Where's the Tylenol?
Kind of weird that Jay Cutler listening somewhere thinks, wait, how did I get into this? What did I do wrong? They got mad at, they were so upset yesterday at the loss, they got mad at Jay Cutler. They were, I knew it was going to be a tough day for him.
So, yeah, it seemed like the Raiders kind of wanted the Bears to win.
they gave him some right? opportunities there.
I think they did. And they gave up some opportunities. But here's my thing. I'm watching the game and I'm thinking, why does John Gruden do it? Because he's clearly not enjoying himself.
Yeah.
I've never seen a guy more unhappy in every frame of a football game than he was.
I thought I saw a smile across his face at the end of the game when he walked across the field to shake somebody's hand.
Was it Jay Cutler's?
It was like, wait, I'm pretty sure Cutler isn't the quarterback. I'm pretty sure that Cutler had nothing to do with this. But they were mad at, I don't know how they got there, but they got there. So, at a jazz bar in Lockport, three Grabowskis just lamenting the loss and the long 2 weeks it's going to be. I'll pick up a couple of phone lines here. The number's 312-981-7200. Thanks for your calls. And we were talking a little bit about that altercation I saw between a bike and an SUV on Halstead over the weekend. Ken wanted to say what? You're on WGN. Hi, Ken.
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So what I see is, and which is very frustrating, that the people that purposely try to go across four lanes of traffic out of some little mini mall at 5 o'clock, it's like, really? If you just took a right, go down a block, and make your way home, I'm sure there's an alternative. But you persistently have to make that left-hand turn at 5 o'clock. You're like, are you kidding me? As opposed to the people that, hey, I made a mistake, own it.
I'm not sure. I think it's UPS. UPS, maybe it's FedEx.
Oh, yeah, so UPS, so in my reference to UPS is, UPS makes all the deliveries making right-hand turns.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. So they have it programmed in their vehicle, so even if it's, they just got to go down a block to the left, they've programmed
it'll be faster to make a right.
They make right turns and go all the way around. They'll do three right turns rather than one left turn, and they get there quicker.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the phone call. I understand your pain, Ken. Thanks for joining us. Frank, you're on WGN. Hi, Frank.
Hey, King John. What you were talking about earlier about blocking the intersection, a lot of people do it intentionally, but my experience is the cab drivers, they will do it intentionally. They don't want to sit through that extra cycle at the intersection.
Yeah.
But I know that if in the New York area, there's a camera that takes a picture of the intersection, and if you're caught in the intersection, you will get a fine, just like a red light camera here in Illinois.
Really? Even if when you crossed it was green or yellow, if you're stuck in there on a red, you get a ticket in New York, huh?
Yeah, if you're caught sitting there idle, just like sitting waiting for traffic to inch up.
Yeah.
And if you're caught there, because it's a hazard, because emergency equipment can't get through, like an ambulance.
You know what happens, too, is the pedestrians now have to snake around you and into the intersection because they can't use the crosswalk. That happens to me all the time. And I'm not one for finding more ways for the city to give tickets, but I wonder if Chicago should do that. Mm-hmm. If you are caught in an intersection, you're the gridlocker, and currently your excuse, your explanation will be, well, but it was yellow or green when I crossed the line. That's the only thing we ask, is that you don't cross it on the red.
I just don't want to see more cameras in the city. That's what I don't want to see.
I know. But the fix there does sound appealing, doesn't it? I wonder if that would work, if that would clean it up or not. Interesting point. All right, well, hey, listen, thanks for the call, Frank. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, have a good day. We were talking about the Museum of Science and Industry a moment ago and what a good place it is or is not. 619 texted in and said, hey, I live in San Diego. I have never lived in Chicago, but from a tourist point of view, I love the Museum of Science and Industry. 815, hi, I'm John. Hi, John, I'm 22. And my mom would take my little brother and me into the city during spring break for a day if we weren't going anywhere, and I always was most excited to go to MSI. I loved seeing Colleen Moore's Fairy Tale Castle, the Giant Heart, and getting ice cream from the parlor around the corner from the coal mine. The three of us always enjoyed our time. Oh, I'm glad to hear this. 224. I just went a couple of weeks ago. I thought it was so much fun. And yes, there was product placement, but it was so far outweighed by the science. I'm a bit of a science geek. We are lucky to have the Museum of Science and Industry. And on they go. So I'm glad to hear about all of that. Good. Some folks from Condé Nast are going to join us a little later on to talk about why the city of Chicago is the best big city in America. I'm not sure where it ranks in the world, but 600,000 people from around the world voted on this, and they said that Chicago is the best big city in America. Minneapolis is number two, Honolulu, Washington, D.C., San Diego, in Pittsburgh, probably just busting their buttons today. Pittsburgh is in the top 10 as well. You see how much money Warner Brothers' Joker made this weekend? Lauren Lapkus, are you going to go see this movie?
I want to see it, but I'm also one of those people that is not necessarily unnecessarily afraid to go. But I think we talked about this.
It sounds like you are.
Yeah, a few weeks ago we were talking about this, how just in general I get nervous going to some big events just because of the state of the world right now.
Well, that's a thing that I think the media perpetuated more than it was actually in the minds of people, and maybe put it in the minds of people where it wasn't. That whole violence
Definitely.
Thing.
And working in the media, unfortunately, I read all of these things.
Well, I don't know what you're supposed to do if you're, I don't know, CNN or WGN or the Tribune. I don't know how you report that. But I think if you beat that drum a lot, it's interesting. It's another way to tell the story. Maybe it's an even better story, quote unquote. But is it legit? For instance, how real was the threat on opening weekend? You know, there was a history, but did we have reporting? Did we have information that there was a network of people that were going to do something? No. And I don't know. I don't know where that line is.
I think there was only one credible threat that they stopped.
Oh, really? There was one. I didn't even see that.
Something that was found online.
Warner Brothers said the film is, quote, not an endorsement of real-world violence of any kind. Dare Garabedian, a senior media analyst at Comscore, said, I think the controversy helped it this weekend. It became a cultural phenomenon. All the talk around the film made it a must-see event. The film got a 69% score on Rotten Tomatoes. It got some critical acclaim. Some critics didn't like it. It was mixed, but the audience reaction was mostly positive. The film earned a CineScore B+. Worldwide, this weekend, it made $234 million. It made $93.5 million in North America. It makes it the highest grossing opening in the history of October. Big movies don't normally open in October. This one almost did $100 million here. So that's the largest opening for Warner Brothers this year and one of the biggest openings for an R-rated film ever. $234 million worldwide for The Joker. I was at a Quentin Tarantino film, the last one he did. What was it? Life and Times in Hollywood? Was that the name of that movie?
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Hollywood, which is a really good movie.
I still haven't seen that.
That movie is surprisingly funny. Here's the funny thing about it, though. It's Quentin Tarantino, right? And so you know that you're going to get violence and almost cartoonish violence, over-the-top violence. You don't get that in this movie until about the last 20 minutes or so.
Isn't that a really long movie, too?
It is. I thought it was fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
I heard only good things.
It's a really fun. But at the end, you're going, well, for a Quentin Tarantino movie, this isn't. And then bam, bam, bam.
Gotcha.
I know. He's like, don't worry. I'm keeping score. I'm going to give you just what you hoped you'd get in a Quentin Tarantino film. So, you know, I don't know if that attracts a certain kind of audience or not. But at the viewing of it that we saw, two guys got into it. And the one, I've never had this before. The one guy, a couple rows up from me and about 10 seats down to the left, just stands up and turns around and leans into the guy behind him and says, okay, let's go. Let's go. I thought, wow, we're having a Quentin Tarantino moment here at the Quentin Tarantino film. It's almost like you have to pay extra for this.
It's one of those 4D movies. You really get to feel the action.
Yes. In Vibrasound. So Between everybody's like, come on, guys, really? We're just trying to watch a movie here. Could you two please not get in a fight here at the Quentin Tarantino film? And then the one guy sat down, and then life went on. About people driving their cars into intersections and gridlocking the intersection, 630 wrote, it's so rare to get a courtesy wave these days. I am very intrigued by what the caller said, Frank, that they do in New York City. If you are gridlocking that intersection, even if you went into it when it was green, you can see ahead that you might not get through when it changes. And so you'll tell the officer or the oncoming cars, hey, it was green. But you know what you're doing. In New York, you get a ticket. You get a ticket if you're gridlocking that intersection. Are we on board with that? Do we like that idea?
For the majority, I would say yes, but there are some lights that are on busy streets that have not gotten arrows yet.
Yeah,
and you will never get through if you weren't to go past the white line and wait to turn left.
Yeah,
I can't name one off the top of my head right now, but I know that there are several that I've experienced.
I was kind of in that situation this weekend, I think it was. And so then I kind of pulled over to almost like I'm going to park. Like I found a place on the right so that I couldn't go forward, but I kind of veered over around the car in front of me into the parking lane. I wasn't going to park, but at least there was some room there to get out of the way. That was my plan. That was my strategy. And then eventually, you know, he moved forward, but otherwise I would have been stuck out there. So I think a lot of us have been in that situation before. I just think if you personalize the interaction, it goes a lot better. Look at them, wave, give them that, oh, I'm so sorry. Look and feel it. Practice, rehearse this at home now if you have time. Be good at it, but just go, oh, I'm sorry, sorry.
Well, not overreacting, because it's really not worth it to you. You're just making yourself more upset and stressing yourself out.
That's the thing. So in this incident that I ran into where the car and the bicycle are having this argument in the middle of the street, the guy drives his car up, locks the brakes, pins the bicycle against the curb, and then jumps out. And I thought, how are we all living on the edge so that if you cut me off with your bicycle, I'm just going ballistic? That's kind of scary. You know, the bicyclist is probably thinking, even if I'm in the right, I'm not going to win this argument. I'm just going to try and get out alive. You can't feel better about your day when you're laying on the horn or doing something like that.
Right. And I'm sure he felt extra embarrassed after seeing all the spectators of what was going on.
Hey, Marty, you're on WGN. Thanks for calling. What's up?
Yeah. Hi, John. How are you?
Good.
I'm just calling to say that the state of Illinois also agrees with New York. They won't give you a ticket, but you're not supposed to pull out into that intersection unless you have the opportunity to also turn.
Yeah.
They don't want you sitting out there waiting to get in trouble. They want you to be able to pull right through the intersection.
But they're not going to give you a ticket, though, right?
Right. No, I don't think it's that strict here.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they'd rather you not go out there and just sit and wait for the cars to come.
thanks for the phone call. Yeah, you betcha.
Yeah, no problem, John.
Marty, you have a good day. Hey, Jerry, you're on WGN.
Hello. I wanted to say that the Museum of Science and Industry is really the Julius Rosenwald Museum, and he chose not to put his name on the building.
Seriously?
Yes. Google it.
Wait, so I should know this. Who's Julius Rosenwald?
Oh, he was a, what would you call a leader?
Philanthropist?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
And so, yes. So he helped build it. Is that right? He financed it?
Right. It's really the Julius Rosenwald Museum of Science and Industry, and no one seems to remember that.
I do not. I guess, was he the one that put it up for the, you know, the World's Fair? Is that the Columbian Exposition?
You know what? I'm not sure about that.
All right, I'm going to have producer Elif look that up. Julius Rosenwald Museum of Science and Industry.
Right.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, I don't know if any of the Rosenwalds are listening, but they better get on this thing. Thanks.
You're right.
Thanks for the phone call.
You're welcome. Bye.
I didn't know that. You see Eric Zorn's tweet about the World Series game between the Yankees and the Twins? I'm not a Yankees hater per se. I don't think there's any teams that I really root against except for maybe Duke. And I used to love Duke. I used to be a big Dukie. When John Shire was their point guard, from Chicago. I fell in love with that team and then kind of fell out of love with it after he left, and a few incidents with the coach and all. Anyway, the Yankees are playing the Twins. Game two of the World Series in New York, and the Twins are getting spanked in both games. There's a pitcher on the mound for the Twins who last year in the minors, in order to make ends meet, drove Uber. He drove for Uber. This was the chant at Yankee Stadium for game two of the World, not the World Series. This would be the ALDS. You get the idea. Come on, Yankees fans.
That's ridiculous. I mean, just for wanting to make a little extra money.
I think that's good. I actually think that's
commendable.
Better. I mean, like, here's a guy who's making ends meet. He's not too proud to drive an Uber, even though he's got a professional baseball contract. It's 1:57. We'll pause here, get you into the WGN Radio newsroom. Incidentally, also an amazing story about the White Sox after the news.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
All day long.
Here's John Williams.
What we do here, we seek to entertain and inform. I do anyway until 3, and I think Ro and Anna will do a swell job of that after 3.
Lord have
mercy. I want to welcome back to the United States of America one Lauren Lapka. She was with the Blackhawks over in Europe. Kind of weird that our two teams were overseas over the weekend. Didn't work out well for any of them, but
I had a good time.
What matter, Steve Bertrand?
Well, it just, I feel badly for the people who went over to see the games. And
I wondered about that. Like, if you spent all of that time, money, and effort to go to London or Prague, do you care? Like, right? Like, does it really, it doesn't ruin your trip.
You probably care more if you were here watching than if you were there watching.
Yeah, right, because you're still in Prague or London. Right.
Or if you only went for those purposes, hopefully they did other things.
I know.
Well, the Prague people did. I know that.
Oh, was that a Steve Bertrand travel trip?
Yeah.
Visit Steve Bertrand travel.
No, I'll do that. Yes. Thank you. But yeah, there's about 130, and they're all in the air right now on the way home, which makes me feel good.
Everybody got off the ground, huh?
Yep, made their connections.
How long was the flight from Prague?
Well, we had groups connecting in Zurich, one in, I think, London, and one in Paris, because there aren't a lot of direct flights into Prague. So,
you know, the
I had to stop in Munich.
You didn't fly direct?
Mm-mm.
The chatter was, of course, that the Bears went over there so late, they didn't get over there till really Friday for a Sunday game, that maybe they wouldn't be rested. What was it like for you? Not that you were in the same city, but it's really the same thing. It's jet lag, right? You missed, you're 7 hours off. So
I was definitely way off when I first got to Germany, but I've been fine since I came back. I mean, I did go to bed at like 7:30 last night, but I think it's almost worse when you're jumping forward than when you're going back.
I don't know which one that is.
Well, jumping 7 hours forward.
It's easier to go, you think?
I think it's easier if you are gaining 7 hours.
Right. Like, well, put it this way. When I fly to Europe, that's a hard 24, 48 hours.
Right.
Because
then,
you're so tired. And you're fighting it.
When you land, it's really hard. But once you get through that first day, don't you think you're
sure, after 24
right
hours, once you kind of get back on what's going to be your sleep cycle, and it's not going to be perfect, but you can get the hang of it pretty quick. But my point is this. If Brenda and I had to play an NFL football game those first couple of days, we would not be at our peak performance. Now, it would be unusual for Brenda and I to play an NFL football game. Neither of us are really ready for the NFL right now.
And you're not on the same team anyway, so.
A lot of times we're not. But I mean, I don't know. Maybe these youngsters, these young super-duper athletes.
Well, what did the Raiders do? Do you know? Did they go
earlier? They got there a lot earlier. I think they got like 3 days before we did. Something like that. They got there before we did. And I don't care when they got there. I would have given us an advantage. I would have gotten out there, I don't know, Tuesday for a Sunday game. And now maybe the guys, there'll be shenanigans. They'll be going to plays. They'll be doing things they shouldn't be doing, but
pretending to be locked up in the tower.
Right. So London's a swell town. Yeah, Prague is lovely, too, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh. I've never seen such beautiful architecture just everywhere.
And it's like 1,000 years old. Like, we love our buildings in Chicago, but they're 100 years old.
Was it a little soupy for you, though? It didn't look very sunny.
Yeah, there was a lot of rain. It was quite cold, actually. I don't think I've ever flown back to Chicago and said, oh, my God, the weather's so nice here. The sun is shining. It's warm. But it was still not enough to keep me from walking around. So there was a little bit of sunshine here and there.
Do you have sausages on the street, like the wrapped sausages or pretzels? Or
No, I didn't have that,
but we had the random thing that is very popular there, and it almost looks like a giant churro cone with ice cream in it.
Yes, yes.
They're everywhere, and they were so appetizing looking.
It was noticeable on TV, but I don't know what it was like for Steve, your people, or you, Lauren. Steve sent people over to the football game, and Lauren was with the Blackhawks in Prague.
I sent people to the Blackhawks game.
You sent people to the Blackhawks game. Yeah. Lauren was with the football game.
Right.
No,
Lauren
was with the football. We were all Blackhawks.
Well, then I can only ask you one of you. But it sure looked like the crowd for both the football and the hockey game was very pro-Chicago.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And yet the chants and cheers almost seemed louder for the Flyers. So that's where I was getting confused.
Really?
Yeah. Because, so either they're just louder
Well, they are louder.
Feel the need to scream more to prove that there's more of them?
There was a home game for Oakland, but it looked like a home game for Chicago, albeit in Europe, you know. And then for the Blackhawks, there was definitely more of our jerseys and sweaters in the stands, would you say?
From my point of view, yes.
So did you run into the WGN listeners who were there?
Funny enough, I didn't, but my parents saw them from far away.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's right, because you just happened to be over there, right?
Yeah,
Lauren?
I planned this trip over a year ago.
That is hilarious.
Followed me.
I know. Well, when you found out, you thought, why am I paying good money for airplane tickets when I could have finagled to get on the WGN thing, right?
Right. I probably would have saved a lot of money, yes.
Hey, Carrie, you're on WGN Radio. What can we do for you?
Hey, John. Nice speaking with you. A great admirer of yours and Ellis and everybody.
Thank you, sir. What's up?
I bet. Absolutely confirmable. Oakland got there on Tuesday.
That's what I thought.
And, you know, it was so incredible. John Gruden took this game so seriously because he and Mac are nemesis. Hey, is that a word? Or I make that one up?
More than one nemesis? Yeah, nemesis?
Yeah, we'll go with it.
Yeah.
But they really took this game so much more seriously than the Bears did.
Yeah, and, he had a better game than Khalil did, that's for sure.
But they got there earlier, got adjusted. And I saw a thing on SportsCenter. Just saw those guys practicing. I was like, uh-oh. Because they were really going at it. And the Bears were, you know, twiddling their thumbs. But, John, thank you for everything. And I hope that was helpful.
It was. Thanks for the call. We appreciate the information. I don't know. Hampton about lost his mind. Of course, that's kind of what he does. But he was very upset with Mac kind of second wind on the sidelines, you know, acting out of breath or just not totally energized by the moment. And it should have been a great game for him, playing Oakland and all. And it was weird to see how flat we were in the first half. And then you think, son of a gun, we're going to win this thing. Not so much. All right. The Chicago Teachers Union and the Chicago Public Schools continue to face off towards an October 17th walkout date. October 17th. Today's the 7th. T-minus 10 days. I'm reading again from Hannah Leone's story in the Tribune the other day. And I just wanted to mention something about this. First two paragraphs are this. If the Chicago Teachers Union accepts the city's current offer, the average teacher salary will approach six figures by the end of a five-year contract, according to city estimates. You heard us talk about this, maybe. If union members take the deal now, they'll lose a significant bargaining chip in their play for other central demands, like more classrooms or more school nurses, social workers, and librarians, and they'll lose some of their power to strike, as they plan to do on October 17th, unless they settle a new contract first. We're talking about 25,000 teachers, hundreds of thousands of kids, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, families, and so forth. And since it might coincide with a park district strike, and the workers, the park district kind of picked up some of the slack. The last time there was a strike, they said, well, we have facilities, we have programs. It'll be a way for the kids to be involved in something, and the parents won't have to have the kids all the time. But if you line the two up, then it's a double whammy. The number that just keeps jumping out at me is that $100,000 thing. 16% raises, $100,000. I know that you're concerned about the students. You should be. And the libraries and the social workers, to me, it's a sin that we don't have a social worker and a librarian at every Chicago public school. Now, I've been told that those positions are funded, but they don't have them filled. I think that's terrible. But if I'm a school teacher, at the end of the day, my obligation is to feed my family. My obligation is to pay my rent. If you're telling me that we could make $90,000 or $75,000 or $104,000 a year over the course of 5 years, you know, in the last year or the latter years of the contract, we would be at that. I don't know how you walk away from that.
One of the first stories, the big stories I covered when I was starting this business was the teacher strike in, I think it would have been 87. It was right before Harold Washington died. And I'll never forget talking to a woman who said, as she was a teacher, and she said in her school she was the librarian. They didn't have a library. Her library consisted of a push cart that she would take from classroom to classroom.
That's awful. That's terrible.
No, that was 30 years ago. So obviously there's been great progress made, but still a situation.
Maybe not enough. And then, Steve, do I understand now what the mayor is saying is that we're not going to add school days on at the end of the year?
That's what she's saying. Yeah, it would be interesting to see if she can stick to that.
I don't know how you pull that off, because here's the deal. The teachers don't get paid if they don't work, but they're going to make up those days at the end of the year so they don't lose money over the course of 12 months. They just got a budget. They're not going to get a paycheck for the days missed during the strike.
I mean, the school district would lose money, too, if they're not getting state aid for the days they're not in session.
Well, it sounds like they're willing to play hardball. They're saying, guess what? But then we will not extend the school year, so we're all going to lose.
Right, and that's what a lot of people would say in negotiations before the deadline, and then that could be one of the things they give. All right, you give us this, we'll build in the extra days. Everyone will be whole.
No, there's no. You know who? This sounds so cliche, doesn't it? But you know who's really going to lose out are the kids. If kids lose 2 weeks of education, ultimately they're the ones that lose out the most. You know, you're only in seventh grade once, hopefully.
Right. Of course, seventh grade wasn't that great. So
actually, never mind that. Seventh grade,
not
take a
great
pass.
Example.
Punt on seventh. Sophomore year's big. Fourth grade's big. Seventh grade, there's a lot going on in seventh grade. But I think if you're trying to win this in the court of public opinion, it's going to be hard for the teachers to get a lot of sympathy on the picket line unless those other people are intimately involved in the picket itself. You know, teachers, friends and family of teachers, maybe they know more than you and I about the reality of this. But in this day and age where there's a low unemployment, but the wages aren't great, if you have a job that is going to, I just keep reading this thing over and over again, will approach six figures by the end of a five-year contract, and I hesitate to say, because I know that this is poison to a lot of people, but your contact hours are in a nine-month period. Now, I know you work a lot during the summer, and you work before, and you work after. I'm not saying any of that, but the reality is teachers do get a break in the summer that the other people don't. And if you're going to make...
And a long break over the holidays.
So if you're going to make anywhere near six figures, and I know you got to pay into your own pension, you don't get Social Security, I know all of that. Well, I'm telling you, the headline is 16% raise, $100,000.
And they don't get Social Security, but they get an equivalent. You know, I don't think they're paying into Social Security either.
No, they are not.
Right. They're paying into their own
pension plan.
So they get it's along the same track.
That's my point. So when we talk about your salary or mine or anybody in the private sector, we don't say, yeah, but you got to pay into Social Security. Your employer does too. But I mean, we all have deductions for things like insurance or retirement. And that's your version of it. And this is ours. Frankly, I know a lot of people in the private sector that wish they had been in the public sector all along when it comes about time to retire. It's 2:19. I'm interested in your thoughts about where this stalemate is right now. My number is 312-981-7200, and this is WGN. Hey, Bob, you're on WGN Radio. What can we do for you, Bob?
Yeah, so the question that I have is, how was the city able to afford these raises? What did the fact finder that they used find that they don't seem to be articulating out in the public how these can be afforded?
Yeah, I haven't heard the answer to that either. Where is the money coming from to give them a 16% raise?
Yes.
I don't know.
And that goes for the municipal workers of last year, too. They gave out raises last year, and I'm just sitting here wondering, with pension deficits and everything else, how do you find this money?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. The city's offered 16% raises for teachers over 5 years on top of annual step increases, right? Because if you get more education, there's ways that you can also climb up the ladder. Those are step increases. They've reduced the cost of employee health care contributions from initial offers. The union's asking for a 15% salary increase over 3 years as opposed to 16% over 5 years. Either way, I think financially, that looks good to me if I'm a teacher. Where's the money coming from? You know, we've reached out to CPS the last few days. I know they'll join us soon, so I'll make sure I ask that question.
All right.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Maybe you know. But I have, I don't know if that's coming from the state or if they're just going to tax the Bertrands more. I don't know where that money's coming from. Rosemary, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What can I do for you?
You know, I just wanted to clarify a point about Social Security when it comes to teachers and pensions. Mm-hmm. Many teachers were, including myself, worked second jobs where we did pay Social Security. And we did it because we wouldn't qualify for full Medicare upon retirement if we didn't earn enough credits.
Oh.
But we cannot collect full Social Security benefits. They tell us we would be double-dipping if we did that. Even though they double-dip into our paychecks when we work two jobs, we cannot collect full benefits. Congress does, but teachers can't. And I just think it's a point people need to be aware of.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. But if you work your whole life, say your career, as a public school teacher, you're not paying into Social Security, what do you have for insurance, medical insurance, after you retire then? Does the union or the pension cover that somehow?
We get insurance through TRS, the teacher retirement system. However, you have to pay more if you want the full Medicare. And I can't think right now. You get one part. You pay into one part of it, but you don't get the others. Whether it's the hospital coverage, you have to pay extra for that out of pocket if you don't have enough credits earned, which is why you have to work other jobs to get it.
That's a really interesting point. I'm glad you called. Thanks for listening.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
All right, Rosemary. We're following that story here. Oh, I know this one. Wait, I have no idea what this is. Thank you, Mr. Bertrand. It's 2:36 on WGN. I'm John Williams. After the 2:30 news, Elif comes out with some music for us for a reason. What are we listening to?
Formation by Beyonce, which actually made number 4 on Pitchfork's 200 Best Songs of the 2010s.
Yeah.
Others in the top 5 list include Kendrick Lamar's All Right, Grimes' Oblivion, Robin's Dancing on My Own, and Frank Ocean's Thinking About You.
I like Frank Ocean a lot. I don't recognize this song. You like this song?
I like it a lot.
Why is it on your mind today? Just because it's on that list they put out?
Yeah.
It is 2:37 now on WGN. By the way, this is 2019, right? So 100 years ago, 1919, Teddy Roosevelt passed away. I'll have to mention that to him when he's on stage with us at the Elgin Community College at the Blizzard Theater. You know, we do this show where I come on stage with one of the presidents and we chat things up. It's very fun. It's very funny. It's very informative. It's also kind of, I don't know, patriotic's not the right word, and civic is boring, but you feel good about what you did when you watch a show like this. And then I was reading 100 years ago, not only did Teddy Roosevelt pass away, but he missed the 1919 World Series in which the White Sox, you know, through the games. 1919, 2019, there's a new book out about the Black Sox scandal called The Betrayal. And it's written by a guy named Charles Fountain. And I know this isn't real top of mind because, you know, we think about the Cubs and we think about the Sox today, but it's 100 years ago that they threw the World Series. Just a paragraph from that before we go to our guest. We'll talk with some folks from Condé Nast about what a great place Chicago is. But 100 years ago, it was a place of shame. As much as you know who the players are, Charles Comiskey, Shoeless Joe Jackson, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, names that even the passing sports fan knows maybe a little bit about. You don't know who put the money up, right? If they were going to throw the games, who was paying them off? And there's just such an interesting part of the book where they talk about this guy, Arnold Rothstein, who was actually coming up with the cash for these players, which was just a pittance, by the way. But players used to not get paid much. The author says where the money came from has been argued about as much as anything in the Black Sox story, but the only plausible source is Arnold Rothstein. Rothstein himself would always deny involvement. When asked about the 1919 World Series, Rothstein always said his only involvement was betting on the White Sox and losing money. He was never indicted in the case. That was the way it was with Rothstein. In a criminal life that spanned more than a quarter century, he was never convicted of any crime. He had connections and charm and the best lawyers, and nothing ever stuck to him. Escaping culpability for his role in the 1919 series fix may have been Rothstein's most famous dodge, but it was not his most remarkable. Earlier that year, in 1919, he shot three policemen in front of 19 witnesses and got away scot-free. He shot three policemen in front of 19 witnesses and got away scot-free. Here's what happened. He was overseeing a crap game in the West Side in a West 57th Street apartment when at 2 in the morning, and be on the South Side, in a West 57th Street apartment at 2, I don't even know if this is New York or Chicago, now I think about it. Anyway, in a West 57th Street apartment, when at 2 in the morning, there came a heavy rapping on the door and voices demanding to be let in. Rothstein had been robbed twice during private gambling evenings in the previous year, and he wasn't taking any chances. He responded to the knock on the door by firing three shots through the closed door. Each bullet struck a New York City police detective. Three shots, three officers, three wounds. The officers weren't hurt badly, a shoulder wound and two flesh wounds in the arm. Rothstein was as solicitous as he could be. His limousine took the officers to the hospital, knowing they were dealing with a man who had considerable pull with both the courts and City Hall. The cops apologized, saying publicly that they understood gamblers were naturally wary of being robbed and that they should have been clearer about identifying themselves as police. Rothstein was indicted, but the case was dismissed because the policeman had not seen who had fired the shots. And all of the 19 men in the room testified before the grand jury that they didn't see who fired the shots either. All but one denied that he even heard the shots fired. Another testified that he had seen a muzzle flash but didn't know who fired the gun. History's best guess as to what it cost to fix the World Series, the cash actually paid to the seven players who took money for agreeing to be part of the fix, was at most $80,000 to $90,000. This was quite literally pocket money even then to Arnold Rothstein. At the height of his power and celebrity, he would often travel the streets of Manhattan with $100,000 in cash in the pockets of his suits. Rothstein had, in effect, financed the biggest sports scandal in American history with the cash he had on him. The book goes on to talk about the betrayal, the 1919 World Series, and the Black Sox scandal. It's by a guy named Charles Fountain. I'm really enjoying it. It's 2:42 on WGN. Okay, on a phone line from Condé Nast, Mark Elwood joins us on WGN Radio. Mark, this is John. You're on in Chicago. How are you today?
Hello, John. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. What is Condé Nast? Tell me about your website and publication.
Oh, Condé Nast Traveler. We're the best travel publication in America, maybe in the world, I would say. We're there to tell you the best places you need to see, the best new places to go. And, of course, what we're talking about today is our readers have said this year, 600,000 people voted on this, have said the best big city in America, obviously, is Chicago. You would agree with that, right?
I quite would, and that's not and that's me being as objective. By the way, before I moved to Chicago, I lived 8 years in Minneapolis, which is number two, and Chicago is a great city on a whole nother order. It's a world-class city. Minneapolis is a great city, but Chicago is bigger, has more energy, more vibrancy. You know what I mean?
No, I mean, I used to live in, so I have to, I'll put my cards on the table here. I did used to live in Chicago, so I'm totally biased, but this is not my vote. I didn't have anything to do with stuffing the ballots. This is a legitimate result. 600,000 people,
yeah,
you know, 10,000 different votes. This is, I think Chicago has an incredible combination of some small town charm and big city energy, and I think it blends that in a way almost nowhere else quite manages as well.
So this is from people who have, this isn't Chicagoans voting, though. This is travelers who go to various cities, and when asked, I presume, what's the best place you've been, they vote that way?
Oh, completely. I mean, I hope there are some locals who are saying, hey, you know, we prefer to take staycations and visit everywhere else. We've had sort of three decades of people voting on where they like to visit. But this is an endorsement from across the country, across the world, people saying how much they love visiting Chicago. But I wouldn't diss, I'm sure there are some local people who basically said, I know the best big city, it's right in my backyard.
Yeah, no kidding. So then Minneapolis is number two, Boston number three, New Orleans four, Washington, D.C., San Diego, New York City, Pittsburgh, Honolulu, and the 10th of 10 is San Antonio, Texas. Really different cities. I mean, you've got Rust Belts, you've got cities in the north, cities in the south, Honolulu. It's a range, isn't it?
Yes, and I think what is lovely about this, it reminds us there are cities which in America always feel like vacation cities, the sort of Vegases, the Miamis. And you would assume that the top 10 big cities in America would always be cities that you associate solely with vacations. But somewhere like Pittsburgh, which is also one of my, I love visiting with the Warhol Museum, terrific food. I don't think people instantly think of it as, wow, I should go there for the weekend.
Right.
And this is a lovely reminder that there are lots of places to have those adventures, not just the ones that might come straight to mind.
I was in Pittsburgh for a weekend a couple of years ago, first time ever, thoroughly enjoyed it. Well, it was much prettier than I thought it was going to be.
It has, I think what it has, much like Chicago, because it was, you know, a 19th century city, really, the wealth there in the Golden Age, there are extraordinary buildings. Again, it doesn't have Chicago's sort of architectural petri dish, like everything you could want. But downtown has these incredible kind of stone, elaborate skyscrapers that are really quite beautiful. And then there's a funkier part to it, a bit like the West Loop in Chicago, which is a bit more industrial, a little bit younger. But I love that energy there. And, well, you know, New York is on that top 10 list. I'm living here in New York. I don't get into trouble with my neighbors.
Things to do in Chicago, 15 best museums, and then you list them. Field Museum, Science and Industry, Frank Lloyd Wright, Home and Studio, Art Institute, Shedd Aquarium, Roby House, etc. Best things to do in Chicago. And again, I presume this is coming from your readers, right? This isn't you guys making this up.
Completely. I mean, when we pull some lists, so we have two different things going on here. Today, we're announcing all of our readers' choices, so we're asking for their votes. But also throughout the year, we pull together lists, suggested places to visit, like those 24 best things to do, when, you know, we listen to what the recommendations we get in our social channels, our own expertise. I will say that those museums, I think the Roby House on the South Side, I used to spend days in there. I think you could go to Chicago solely to see that, and you wouldn't be disappointed. It's so extraordinary. It is world class, and that's just one location. What's your pick of these? I was going to say, which one of these do you love? You must have a favorite.
Well, I live near the lake, so the Lakefront Trail is important to me. I also work near the Riverwalk, which is relatively new in how it's been improved, and I was happy to see that on there. We visit with the people from the Architecture Foundation, and the Architecture Foundation River Cruise is on your list. So those are three things all on or about the water, which I think makes Chicago special. Too many cities turn their backs on their waterfront. Chicago embraces it with green space and with ways to use it. That's really nice. And then, you know, the museums and the museum campus are all on the water again. I also was just had, let me just mention a couple here. You also have the Chicago Pizza Tour, the museums, You've got Wrigley Field. You have the Bloomingdale Trail, the 606, mm-hmm. which is maybe 2 or 3 years old now. But obviously it's the old elevated L tracks, and you can now bicycle along them for a couple of miles. And I think that's money well spent by the city. The Maxwell Street Market is on your list. There's one other one I was going to mention here. Oh, yeah, Whirly Ball. Whirly Ball. I didn't even know what Whirly Ball was.
You see, we did cover, I think this is the high and the low. I think that's the great reminder. If you want a recommendation of a five-star hotel, we've got you covered. But if you want to know about Whirly Ball, you want to know about the Bloomingdale Trail, we've also got you there. So you can spend nothing, a little bit, or loads. But we're not snobs about this. I will say, I think the Bloomingdale Trail, there are increasingly really good reuses of urban railways, like the High Line in New York, the Promenade Plantée in Paris. Again, I think the Bloomingdale Trail more than holds up there. I think it's that lovely green space that's still a social space, and bridging those two is an amazing achievement. I love it. I wish it had been there when I was living there.
Getting back to Whirly Ball, so as I understand it, it's this place, you go and you have drinks and food, and then you can bowl, but the Whirly Ball part is that you ride bumper cars with like lacrosse wickets and a ball. And then as you're driving around with the bumper cars, passing the ball to your teammates, you zip the ball at kind of like rollerball at a goal, and maybe you score, but mostly you're drinking and eating and driving around on bumper cars.
I mean, don't you think it combines? Have you played it?
No, I think I'd like to try that.
I was going to say, this is how you want to talk about it, because you really want to. We could go together. I think it combines that good timing in Chicago with that love for sport. It's basically sort of high-life basketball. I mean, it sounds a bit like a spoof. It sounds a bit like it was an SNL skit.
Right.
But it's great fun, and it's only played in a small number of locations, requires a special court. And luckily, you have one in Chicago again. Where would you have one? Of course, you'd have one in Chicago.
Yeah, Chicago has one. Brookfield's getting one. I think Naperville has one. And then the other one's in Colorado. So it sounds like of the four that I was able to find, three of them are here or are going to be in the Chicago area. And then one last thing, just a real quick note.
Yeah,
and this is from Condé Nast, the best places to eat and drink. A lot of these are kind of high-end, right? So Elsky, Alinea, Spiaggia, Beef Buff House, Band of Bohemia, Kumiko. I was just talking the other day about Pequot's Pizza, and I saw that made the list. Parachute, Duck Duck Goat is on there.
Of course.
I think the only criticism I would have would be that if you're traveling in Chicago, you're going to need some money if you're going to do that.
Yeah, but I would also say, but we've got lists. We've got the best pizzas in Chicago. We've got Bert's Place, and we've got Lou Malnati's. We've got Pizzeria Uno. You don't have to splurge, but I do think with people like Stephanie Izard in Chicago, Alinea, Grant Ashatz, those they really have upped the game. And I think you're selling yourself short not to splurge, maybe on at least one meal.
Yeah,
so,
maybe
so. What would be your pick?
I just recently went to Duck Duck Goat, not recently, but this past year we got food from there. And I thought that was fantastic. I thought that was a game changer for me. In that category, I thought that was, I got a birthday coming up, and I may just go back there for that because it was really, really good. So that's what I enjoy.
I'm glad. You see, Condé Nast Traveler is not, it's about some high end. We love the low end too. We love the low end too, but it's always just got to be delicious, whatever you're paying.
Yeah. Hey, it's nice to talk to you. So this is a Condé Nast Traveler. I guess if I go to Condé Nast, I'll find all of this information.
You can go to cntraveler.com and you will see all the lists. It's not just about Chicago, but everything our readers love across the world. So you can compare the lists.
Nice to talk to you, Mark. Thanks for your time today.
You too, mate.
Mark Elwood at Condé Nast. Kevin, I have about 19 seconds. Do you want to say anything about the game?
I'll save my rant for after the 3 o'clock news, but I will say I was here yesterday and I could feel the radio station shaking as Hamp and OB were recapping that loss.
Yeah. It's funny because they were like, especially Ed Obradovich, saw some good things about the game. You know, the quarterback actually did pretty well, and there was this and there was that. But then they start, it's like a train going down the tracks. Once they get going, and then they start to think about it more, and then they get angry, and then they go faster, and then they get really mad.
I've never heard Hamp that fired up before, believe it or not.
His
rants, yes. It was basically right off the top of the show, was just something to behold.
We set them to jazz music with a bar in the background and played it at 1:30. I don't know if you heard that, but maybe I'll do that again tomorrow at 1:30 or 2:30, just so you can get a sense of the joy, the camaraderie, the anger, and the entertainment of it. But first, we'll get ready for Roe and Anne.